This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Stuart Brand, an American writer and ecologist, best known as editor of the Whole Earth Catalog. He's founded a number of organizations including The Well, the Global Business Network, and the Long Now Foundation. Stuart's the author of several books, most recently Whole Earth Discipline, in which he takes an optimistic view of the future of this whole Earth. In part one of our discussion, we talk in depth about Stuart's recent pro-nuclear energy stance. Unusual in that it comes from one of the fathers of the modern environmental movement, but not surprising given this innovative thinker's unorthodox approach to solving problems. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, Stuart.
Thank you for having me.
Stuart, you've had a long and varied journey. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got to where you are today?
Once upon a time, back in 1968, started a series of books called The Whole Earth Catalog. And that was after I'd graduated from Stanford as an ecologist, went off to the Army to be an infantry lieutenant, and then came back to the Bay Area and hung out with artists like Ken Kesey and Grateful Dead and Acid Tests. I organized the Trips Festival in 1966, and Whole Earth became a sort of term because I had an LSD trip in later in 1966 where I decided that we needed to see a photograph of the whole Earth from space, and that would change everything when we did, and sold buttons that said, why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet? And sure enough, when that photograph came along and from the Apollo program in 1969, you had Earth Day in 1970, which completely cohered an environmental movement that previously didn't know it existed. And pretty much the environmental movement that we're operating with now is a direct, not very far-changed set of ideas and emotions and activities that were pretty well established by the end of the 1970s. You could say that part of my critique is it's out of date. The environmental movement taking climate seriously needs to look at the state of the world now and the state of technology now and operate accordingly.
One of the biggest newsmakers from the book is that longtime environmentalist and founder of the Whole Earth Access Catalog, Stuart Brand, is pro-nuclear, which flies in the face of a lot of common conventional wisdom. Tell us the evolution in your thinking and how that came about.
Well, from some people's standpoint, that's not the worst of it. I'm not only saying that nuclear is green, I'm saying that the cities are green and genetic engineered food crops are green. And population is not the problem we thought it was, and geoengineering, direct intervention in the climate may well be necessary. But I'm also saying that restoring wildlands is even more of the essence than it's been before, and there's lots of new practices and technologies that can be applied there as well. So from my standpoint, I'm just trying to be what I think an environmentalist needs to be in the 2010s, dealing with climate change is the very top of the priority list now.
And tell our listeners why nuclear.
Well, the main event on nuclear is that it is now and has been for quite a while and shows signs of increasingly being a source of the kind of electricity you need to run a city, base load electricity. It's always on 24/7. And if you try to rely just on renewables that go on and off so far, because we don't have massive energy storage like wind and solar, you can't rely very far. You can get up to 20-30% of your electricity using those very good and very important supplements. But the base load electricity is either going to come at present from coal, which we don't want, from hydro, which is good but largely maxed out, or from nuclear, which is good and can be greatly increased. So the people who've run the numbers, like Saul Griffith and David Mackay, who's head of chief scientist for climate and energy in the Great Britain's government, they're basically saying we have to do everything full bore starting yesterday. And by everything, they absolutely include nuclear. David Mackay's great quote is, I'm not trying to be pro-nuclear, I'm just pro-arithmetic. And wind and solar and geothermal and other things are great, but they don't add up to anything like enough to make a difference on climate.
When you're talking about the, in the book, with the genetically modified crops, you mentioned the precautionary principle. What's meant by the precautionary principle, and maybe how does the precautionary principle then apply to the issue of nuclear energy?
I think the precautionary principle has become a way to kind of institutionalize nervousness, and in a way that is not all that helpful. Originally, the precautionary principle was used in Europe when there was signs of harm, such as acid rain in Europe, but where there was not a clear scientific understanding of what was causing the harm. And the idea of the precautionary principle was to start taking action against causes of the harm, even though they were not clearly understood yet, which is a pretty smart thing to do. And indeed, it helped eventually head off climate change in Europe, or sorry, head off acid rain effects in Europe. And then it migrated to precautionary principle could be used to critique and often try to shut down any new technology or new practice that anybody could imagine something might go wrong with. And so it became in a way anti-science. Anybody with any notion of what might be wrong with something or other, such as transgenic crops, genetic engineering, could say, well, we must not do this because I imagine, in my state of not very great knowledge, that this terrible thing might occur, and therefore we shouldn't do it. So there's many people who've tried to, like Parliament in England, forbade the use of the precautionary principle in any legal activities, public activities in England, because they found it was so destructive. It just meant that nobody tried anything. And other people have tried to rewrite the precautionary principle. My own approach is to keep it. I think it's a good idea. I think it has especially its early history is really important. But what I add to it is the idea of the vigilance principle. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And the idea here is that when one is worried about, as one should be, about any new practice or new technology, spell out the worries, and then spell out the means to track on what actually happens in real life with the new practice, the new technology, and see if those worries play out. And if they don't over time, then you move those worries down the list. It looks like a bad thing is not happening yet. For example, many people were worried when genetically engineered food crops first came along in the 1990s that they would somehow act as some kind of poison in food and it would be bad for people. And 15 years later, we can say that Americans have been eating this stuff for 15 years now, and no harm has been detected. So that it is somehow bad to eat, I think we can take off the list. That's just what vigilance shows you. But you can have bad surprises with anything new. You want to be watchful for those. You can have good surprises with anything new. So when cell phones came along, people were worried about, oh, there was going to be harm to the brain. There was going to be corporations were going to take over the world in terms of communications. The digital divide would get even worse and so on. In actuality, the opposite of all those things occurred. But on the other hand, we did have new forms of rudeness that we're still learning to figure out. And so I want to see the precautionary principle used as a way to think about trying new stuff, because we're now in dire enough straits with climate and everything else. We're going to need to try a whole lot of things and not shut them down in advance by being worried about them. do shut down the ones that don't work out so well and move ahead on the ones that look like they are starting to work pretty well and see if they can work better. So that's the kind of pragmatism I'm seeing it needs to come to the fore when we're in a situation like we are now.
And you use an anecdote to explain it also, something regarding steak knives.
Well, this is Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, says, you're opening a restaurant and you'd like to serve steak, but then somebody, the equivalent of a software engineer in his business says, well, you know, if you're going to have steak, you're going to have steak knives. And people can really hurt each other with steak knives. So what are we going to do about that? And then the engineer, being a good engineer, says, well, I think we can, since we know that problem may well be a problem, we can design around it by having cages around each of the tables so that we can limit the damage. If anybody goes berserk with a steak knife, they can only hurt the people at their own table. And I think that'll be a sufficient precaution to take here. And as Jimmy Wales says, as soon as you try to prevent bad things, what you basically do is prevent good things from occurring. And so Wikipedia has taken off in the world to a large extent because Jimmy and the rest of the people working at the core of that operation figured that they could trust people to do the right thing over time, especially when they're all doing it visibly in light of each other's close attention. And so the steak knives fable is I think, an example of precautionary principle run amok.
And it seems like the way we've, the arguments against nuclear energy are largely based in that as well. I just saw online at the TED conference, you and a Stanford professor debating.
Mark Jacobson.
And the last slide he used was the mushroom cloud. It was almost obligatory, even though he made a very cohesive argument, and you contrasted your last slide with Homer J. Simpson,
which
I think you won over the crowd with that one.
I just want to talk to you. I won't do you no harm. I just want to know about your different lives on this here people farm. I hear some of you have families living in cages, tall and cold. Some just sit there and dust away past the age of old. But is this true? Please let me talk.
Now back to our discussion with Stuart Brand.
Are we going to be basing our policies on the worst possible case scenario, like it would Jimmy Wales' steak restaurant?
Well, the great advantage we have with nuclear is that it's people keep treating it like it's a new technology. And happily, it's a very, very mature technology. We've had it going for 40 years now. Some countries like France rely on it for 80% of their electricity. We've gone through all the early kinds of mistakes you could have. There was the Windscale fire in England with one of their research reactors early on. We had Three Mile Island, which was great in a way because it came out just a couple of weeks after China Syndrome movie. And everybody expected that a meltdown at Three Mile Island would mean that the meltdown reactor material would go through the, you know, head toward China. Well, in reality, it got 5/16 of an inch toward China in the containment vessel, cooled off like it was designed to do. And the worst thing that happened is it shut down a productive reactor and also helped frighten the industry. So those things were bad. But in terms of meltdown being destructive, it was not outside of the reactor itself. And then Chernobyl showed once and for all that if you don't have a containment vessel and you have pretty bizarre management, you can indeed have a steam explosion that can release some of the material to the environment. And indeed, 56 people did die as a result of that.
You said in the book that there weren't a lot of deformities because there was a high number of abortions, preemptive abortions after the accident. And just as an aside, I had mentioned this to my wife, and I knew she had been to Kiev, in her teens or early 20s with her family. And she said that doesn't sound right to her. She saw a lot of people on the street who had these thalidomide type, what we associate with radiation poisoning type deformities.
Yeah, part of the nuclear thing, this comes from, I was there for the science fiction films of the 1950s and things like Them and The Thing and so on. And all of the villains were, all of the bad things like giant ants were caused by, in those days, radiation from the nuclear bomb tests. And, you know, I was terrorized by all of that as much as anybody. But the science turns out, very, very close study was made of people who survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And to their surprise, no birth defects, no unusual high rate of birth defects showed up after those events. And when the United Nations sent three different departments off to the Chernobyl area to examine, do serious epidemiology, serious statistical studies of, you know, was there increased cancer rates, increased birth defects, what were the actual lingering problems from the Chernobyl radiation release? And they found no increased birth defects at all. There's birth defects everywhere. I think especially in areas that drink a lot of alcohol, you're going to have fetal infant syndrome and things like that.
So maybe my wife's perceptions were tilted a little bit by the fact that she knew that Chernobyl had happened not that far from Kiev.
I think that's, you know, understandably, when you're worried about something, you look for signs that that worry is being fulfilled. But the actual statistical studies on the ground show that there was no extra birth defects after Chernobyl and no extra cancers. So when they say, well, of the 600,000 people most exposed, there might be 4,000 that die early because of cancer, that's too small a number to actually detect on the ground. It's just based on a conjectural theory about low dosage damage over time. So Chernobyl was indeed terrible, but compared to things like Bhopal, where 5,000 plus died, they're just, you know, different orders of magnitude.
But not as dramatic in the public mentality.
Not as dramatic in the public eye. And I think part of, especially in the U.S. and maybe in Europe, part of our aversion to nuclear power is a transfer of our quite proper aversion to nuclear weapons. And yet, the third most nuclear nation after us and France is Japan, which is moving very rapidly to get even more nuclear energy than they do already. For pretty much the same reason as France, actually, which is, as they put it, no coal, no oil, no choice. And it's not like they were trying to avoid burning fossil fuels. They just didn't have any locally that they could rely on, and so went straight to nuclear. And as a result, gigatons of carbon dioxide kept out of the atmosphere by those nuclear power plants.
I mean, you talk about how the worst case scenario is a nuclear bomb goes off in a city, or we have some terrible nuclear accident, which could happen, but we know that we're burning X amount of coal every day.
Well, there I was quoting Bill McKibben, who has said that an accident in a nuclear power plant could be pretty damaging, but burning coal causes drastic amounts of damage on purpose, doing what is normally intended to do. You know, even when we used to worry mainly about scrubbing the particles, the aerosols that come out of coal burning, and we have done that in Europe and in the U.S. It's not, and it's starting to happen in a good way in China and maybe in India, but that turned out to be a good thing to have done. But carbon dioxide is a whole lot harder to scrub, and all of our coal-fired plants and everybody else's is still cranking out massive gigatonnage of what is turning out to be a very deleterious addition to the atmosphere. And, you know, all of the mercury that's going into the atmosphere, which is why we're not supposed to, if we are pregnant, we are not supposed to eat wild fish because of the mercury that's in the food chain from our burning coal. And, you know, in California, we're getting nice red sunsets now thanks to Chinese coal.
Beautiful, but not as...
Beautiful, but you don't want to breathe it.
Right. One of the arguments you make is that people who know the most about nuclear energy are strong proponents of it.
Universally the least worried. And the opposite is the case with climate. Almost all the people who know the most about climate are the ones who are the most worried.
Obviously, we want knowledgeable people to be evaluating these alternatives. But is it a fair criterion to judge the science from people who are so closely invested in it? I'd be interested to know how people from the wind industry or the oil industry or solar industry would talk about the likelihood that their solution is the best or that it's the safest.
There's a certain amount of professional defending one's industry, in a sense. I'm hoping that one of the side effects of the current debates about climate will be that people learn to distinguish between sources. And if somebody's on a payroll and doesn't have all that distinguished a scientific record or is actually outside of their domain, one does not pay as close attention to a scientist who's outside their specialty.
We're talking with Stuart Brand, environmentalist, merry prankster, and author of the provocative green manifesto, Whole Earth Discipline.
Nuclear is here, it's now, and we know that it can produce the kind of numbers that we need to generate enough electricity for massive numbers of people. But one of the criticisms is that it just takes so long to build these facilities.
It takes long to build a large facility, and it depends on where you build it. In China, when they start working a large reactor, it's done in 3 years. And they probably don't have what used to be 12 years of regulatory process to go through that the U.S. has done. In France, typically it's 4 years, and they have completely safe reactors, so that seems to be adequate. And indeed, the process is being accelerated in the U.S. They'll be closer to the way it's done in France. But I think the great breakthrough is that one doesn't have to build a 1 gigawatt or 1.6 gigawatt reactor, a Westinghouse or an Areva reactor. There's people finally caught on that it's perfectly good technology at a smaller scale. It could be down as low as 1/60th of that scale, down around 25 to 125 megawatts, which is enough for a small town. And the difference there is two. One, it's smaller, so it costs less to just build it. They're modular. They're called small modular reactors. And so you can start with one, and if you like what you got, bring in others, and they work in tandem. The other thing is you don't have to build them on site, these big, complex, heavy metal operations. You build them at a factory and take them on a truck or a train or a boat to the site, rotate them 90 degrees, stick them in the ground. The ground is the containment vessel. They're built to be a lot simpler, safer. Nuclear power plants these days are really safe, but they're even safer, these smaller ones. There's no weaponization capability, and sort of thing that we environmentalists have been pushing for a long time, which is it's good to get your power source close to the customer. Therefore, you don't have the huge power lines that we currently have to do for wind, for example. And you get a much more adaptive system with lots of local sources of power. So it looks like the small modular reactors are moving ahead, and they can move very quickly. Not only are they quick to build, but you've got a much shorter design cycle. So as you learn things from the first ones, you can make them better and better, and faster, cheaper and cheaper, come down the learning curve. And that, in a way, changes the whole nuclear industry from this massive operation, which does have economies of scale. It's probably lowest cost per kilowatt hour of any of these things. But it becomes at a time when you're trying to move quickly and trying to move in lots of different ways in different places. I think these small reactors are going to be better.
Now, you're pro-nuclear, but you're...
Didn't used to be,
but you're against reprocessing. Is that right? In general?
Well, I'm There was a very good article in IEEE Spectrum, the engineer's magazine, on just doing a nice, close, open-minded analysis of reprocessing in France. And to my surprise, they found it was pretty darn expensive and a gnarly process with kind of a gnarly outcome in a way. And the thing that we've done in the U.S., which was to use just once through fuel. And I thought, well, that's kind of wasteful because some 95% of the energy is still there in that so-called spent fuel. But we may be better having kept it around, mostly at the reactor sites in dry cask storage, where it's perfectly fine for a century or so. And as the fourth generation reactors, the integral fast reactors, come along, they use that spent fuel as fuel. So you don't even have to reprocess it. And so as we move into fourth generation reactors, various places in the world, we'll be mining the spent fuel as the most valuable source of energy we have, much as we have been mining Russia's warheads for the last 10 years in a program called Megatons to Megawatts, where U.S. has quietly been buying up, I think it's something, 16,000 nuclear warheads from Russia. And 10% of our electricity in the United States comes from these warheads that used to be aimed at us. We're lighting up our towns instead of exploding them with the same energy source. So, and we haven't even started on our own stockpile. And the hope is that over the next couple decades, pretty much all of the governments of the world and all of the policy people across the political spectrum would like nuclear weapons to disappear from the world, please, everybody's. And they're realizing that the nuclear renaissance that's now going on may be a means to make that happen, not just by burning up the old warheads as fuel for electricity, but the kind of program that Obama's been pushing of fuel banking, so that countries that are getting nuclear for the first time, like Dubai, the United Arab Emirates is getting several Korean, South Korean reactors. They don't want to mess with fuel. They don't want to try to, you know, buy uranium from Australia or deal with spent fuel and have to figure out, are they going to reprocess it? Or are they going to bury it in the ground or what? So what they're doing is saying, set up your fuel bank, some kind of international consortium that will handle the fuel. We'll rent the stuff. We'll get our electricity out of it and turn it back over to the source. And you guys can go bury it in the ground or reprocess it or whatever you want. It's actually a pretty good deal. But the great thing that I think promises is that the international organizations that watch this stuff will get the ability to basically track all fissile material in the world, which is what you want. So that not only you know where the fuel is, where the bombs are, where anything that might be in the process of getting concentrated toward weapons-grade material, like in Iran, that would all be known about and highly transparent. And economically paying its own way because it would be generating electricity for a lot of people who need electricity. Another part of the story is that the developing world is coming on fast. People are getting the hell out of poverty by the millions at a time. That means they're starting to eat better food and they're using more energy. The global South is going to get air conditioners.
That's part one of our discussion with Stuart Brand, American writer and ecologist. Stay tuned to Sea Change Radio in the weeks ahead for the second part of our discussion. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our theme music is by Sanford Lewis. Additional music by Ricky Lee Jones, Jerry Garcia, and Alex Wise. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.